Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I had Will McManus and Ed Ebben. Will and Ed are the founding partners of MD1 Ventures, Europe's first dedicated national security VC fund. Will is a former special forces officer with a decade of operation experience and stints in the Foreign Office and British Army. Will brings a frontline perspective to the strategic and technological gaps in today's defense landscape. Before founding MD1, he was a director at Investbridge Capital and held roles at BlackRock and Citi, building a rare bridge between financial acumen and battlefield insight, whilst Ed was a driving force behind the UK's first defence battle lab, the Ministry of Defence Innovation Hub, connecting emerging tech with specialist users. In today's episode, we talk about how the adversarial arena has changed, but that the adversaries are still there. How can we develop the ability to ask better questions, given the amount of data that's out there? And how each matter in defence is put in the context of contest?
There are a whole range of different geopolitical narratives and geopolitical priorities being played out, and a whole load of different states, you know, contesting each other. I think everything is within a context of there's a lot going on.
How defence should be looked through the lens of prevention. How can you ensure that you don't get to conflict in the first place? How a lot of the success in the US comes from access to capital, and why we're seeing a reminder that security and vigilance is a collective endeavor.
What's interesting from the technology side of things, which is something that's changing, is that small to medium enterprises are producing parts of the solution.
How grey zone activity is escalating, but there are clear steps that can be taken to mitigate them, and whether or not we're back in the great game. And if so, what now?
I think the grey zone largely is, and therefore we're now looking at, you know, economic statecraft and all the rest of it. But I probably wouldn't have picked selling off a bunch of coke in order to shut down a furnace. And it turns out if you shut down a furnace, it breaks.
Also, how do we demystify defence?
Well, I'm fully on board with taking people from other parts of the political divide. You know, we dealt with Bournemouth Arts University, which is not an obvious one to deal with. But the stuff they do is incredible.
Let's get straight into it. Hey guys, whilst I've got you for a minute, I thought I'd reintroduce myself. My name's Arish. I'm the host of Nothing Venture, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture ecosystem go round. I'm also the founder of Emerge One, a consultancy that provides fractional CFO support to venture-backed tech startups from C to Series B and beyond. If you love the podcast, we would really appreciate it if you like, rate, and subscribe on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, or wherever it is that you listen. And if you ever want to talk to me, do reach out on LinkedIn or Twitter. Tell me about a guest that you'd like to have on or anything else that you want to tell me about the podcast. I'm always willing to have a conversation. Right, let's get straight into it. Ed, Will, really great to have you in the studio with me. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. I want to dive straight in and talk a little bit about the early years, right? So you've both been in or around defense since the early 2000s. Ed, I know you're in the reserves from sort of 2005 and you've worked together for over a decade. But back then, the world felt, for want of a better word, simpler, at least to me. And maybe that was because I was younger as well and sort of sat out in Papua New Guinea maybe. But we had a clear narrative, right? The war on terror. And then we had this sort of post-Cold War landscape, the peace dividend. What was that era like from the inside for you guys? And how did it shape your thinking on the world we now live in?
It was straightforward in some senses, in that it was a clear fight. It was warfare in the very basic terms, the kind of warfare that you actually train for. Mm. What was different was that the enemy, as it, the, how we would phrase it, was not wearing uniform, not easily identifiable, and there were lots of complexities and nuances to civilian populations that you were amongst, and all the things that are sort of very normal now were fairly new back then.
Mm. Yeah, so I guess that shift from you're no longer warring nation states, you're warring against insurgents, we're fighting against insurgents rather than, you know, insignias, if I can put it that way.
Yeah.
And so, Will, maybe, like, how have you seen that shift? I mean, so in terms of kind of our military capabilities, if I can put it that way, or our understanding of those sort of arenas of combat, were we quick to catch on and figure out how to cope with that or not? Like, how would you describe that?
Well, I suppose without being cheesy, I mean, we're talking about an extension of politics by other means. Mm. So we have a whole range, and we have had a whole range of adversaries, mm-hmm. you know, multi-spectrum adversaries that, you know, in past careers we have contested, and in current careers we are with partners both in government, out of government, contesting. Mm. You know, much like any corporate walk of life, You have your adversaries, you're pitching for deals, you're looking to find natural resources, you're looking to demonstrate, you know, product validity above others, et cetera, et cetera. So how I'd characterize the current world is that there are a whole range of additional new adversarial factors that one needs to consider. Mm. But it's worth mentioning that the threats, you know, the extremist ideology threats haven't gone anywhere, you know, and they manifest in a whole range of different ways, not sometimes, you know, non-traditional ways. Some are close to home, some are overseas. There's a whole range of issues. Mm. So all I'd say now is that something that had an environment whereby a society had enjoyed the peace dividend from the, you know, our parents would have seen the Cold War as a major existential threat, and they would have viewed that as a major problem. I think now we're just seeing that particular adversarial environment resurging, and it's becoming more to the fore, and people are more worried about it. But it's being manifested in different ways. I mean, look at the most recent announcement with the steel industry in the UK.
Yeah, just been nationalized.
I mean, here we go. I mean, this is an exact example of a state-based adversarial contest. Mm. I think it's quite important to just acknowledge it as a contest. Mm. It is imperative for our national interest and our national security that we win.
Yeah, it's absolutely been framed as national security. So this is the takeover of the steel plant, actually announced today, I think, today or yesterday. And essentially, you know, the premise being that the Chinese operators were potentially using the plant as a means to subvert purchase of local steel and actually potentially, you know, bolster the Chinese supply of steel into the UK and or other things, none of which, you know, I necessarily know about. And yeah, it comes back to your point around security and how do you, you know, because I think for the layman, you know, we think about security probably more in terms of police force, military, et cetera. But actually in reality, security is, as you'd said earlier in kind of the quickfire, everything from, yes, defending your borders to supply chain, to food security, to energy security and beyond, right? I guess one question I have just on this point that Will was making around, you know, that adversarial sphere still exists just in a different form. So one of the things that I kind of have thought about, maybe not particularly deeply, but certainly do think about is, why is it since sort of 2001, 2007, we haven't really seen large-scale terrorist attacks in the UK, in Europe, in the US, and beyond? Is that because we have become better at understanding, neutralizing, or identifying these threats before they occur? Or is it that, again, those were events that happened because, you know, those terrorists understood that it was, you know, there was a gap essentially that they could take advantage of, but that gap is now tightened so much that it's a different different plan.
In simple terms, and it almost comes back to you sort of asking what life was like on the ground in the early days. Effectively, you know, adversarial environments, conflict creates innovation, which forces you to be better because you have no choice other than to be constantly
doing. You have to learn,
And if you roll it back to, you know, September the 11th, after that happened, the CIA looked left and right and went, we missed this because we all look the same. Yeah, so they changed. Mm. And that's the bit, and it's that constant evolution, that constant. So it's not that there are no terrorists trying to attack. It's just that we're raising our game and they're raising their game and we're raising our game in response and so on and so forth.
And much like any other sector, constant iteration, constant learning, constant evaluation or reflection is imperative for any capability's survival, any capability's growth, you know, and in turn, any technology, you know. So it's all very well saying, hey, we've built a fantastic product in, you know, any investment ecosystem. But unless you reflect your market's desires or requirements for that product, somebody else is going to come and steal your market. Yeah. So I think, you know, there's been some fantastic work has been done across that sector, but, you know, and continues to be conducted.
Yeah. And just to close off kind of this section from your perspective, so where did you get to know, not necessarily physically, where did you get to know each other, but how did you get to know each other? And I mean, Will, you mentioned sort of earlier in the quickfire again that, you know, MD1 came out as a result of some of the questions and challenges that Ed was sort of harping on about, if I can put it that way. But did you know each other well? Were you close Or was it kind of just a working relationship that grew into something more?
Well, you were a guinea pig, I think, for some of my technologies, Will.
Pretty much, yeah, it was charming.
Willingly or unwillingly, and they still here to tell the tale. Yeah. So
It's worth these ecosystems. It's worth mentioning that there are a whole range of different teams' contributions that come together in order to deliver outputs across the government, national security, corporate, whichever walk of life. And we met in an environment whereby everybody was contributing their specific sector speciality, their team or professional capability, and you all come together. So we met within that environment, but that's not an atypical environment at all. There are plenty of founders and founding teams that we meet from, yes, albeit security backgrounds, generally speaking.
Yeah.
But the founding teams have come together. Someone might have been a finance guy. Someone might have been a legal professional, etc. It doesn't really matter.
Mm.
But when you are faced with a common problem set, you need to make sure that you have diverse minds available,
absolutely.
And you need to make sure you've got different complementary skill sets together.
Yeah.
So that was the genesis of how we got together. And of course, then the other members of our team bring additional who aren't here today. Bring additional specifically financial services or specific venture capital or innovation backgrounds.
Yeah.
So that's how it sort of works.
Yeah. No, I mean, absolutely. And I think, you wouldn't be the first VCs to have come on this podcast and talked about that sort of need for that diversity of skill set and mindset, if I can put it that way, amongst teams. Because I guess, you don't frame everything that you invest in very specifically as pure defense, right? I think, you've talked about the hashtag dual use or diversity of use, which means that actually you can't look at everything just purely through that one lens of, will this assist the military, right? So So having that expertise that can look across kind of sectors and across kind of use cases becomes even more imperative, right? Otherwise you run the risk, I would assume, of pigeonholing yourself into one space.
Yeah, and it's worth mentioning that within and it's very common knowledge, within government, there are numerous attempts to, have a cross-Whitehall approach, is the phrase.
Mm.
Cross-Whitehall approach, is the phrase. That is all about collaboration. It's all about government departments getting together and working together to identify problems. And, we expect founders to understand that everyone needs to contribute to parts of problems or parts of solutions within the ecosystem. And a particular anomaly within government procurement, as opposed to other procurement, is the consortium environment. It's almost mandatory that large programs are run by or delivered by consortiums or consortia. And then, founding teams and innovation teams need to be able to work with others, work well with others to be able to exist within that ecosystem.
Yeah. I mean, just to pull on that thread, because it doesn't often feel like the government does work across Whitehall. It feels like that can be often quite challenging. And there are obviously fiefdoms and different sort of departments pulling, with different agendas. In your experience, both, I guess, internally as well as externally, have you seen that working well?
Government, we can get hung up on governments, the pros and cons of it. It's a big corporate entity and it has the same problems of interdepartmental communication as a huge corporate, but frankly. But sometimes the stakes are higher than just whether you're going to make money or not. Mm. It does, to a large degree. There are fiefdoms sometimes for good reasons. Other times there's a recognition. I think it's definitely safe to say, necessity is forcing more collaboration because you just can't get the skill sets within the system.
Got it.
Like, you can't take the military as a standalone entity. There are skill sets there that it does not have and will never have and has to source from elsewhere.
Mm.
But actually doesn't mean they need to join the military. They can work in a cross collaborative team.
There's one thing that came to mind as you were saying that. Like, there's been lots of kind of memes on Twitter and elsewhere of kind of government jobs at really ludicrously low pay grades for what seem to be quite senior positions. And I wonder whether that ability to attract the right type of talent is somewhat hampered by obviously the purse strings to some extent, or whether, and again, this is probably not really a question as such, but amusing, whether actually people with that sort of mindset of, public service, we want to work, we want to give back, we want to be able to help our nation and our government go into those roles irrespective of the pay, right? But I do wonder whether, there's a lot of talk about whether privates, and there's always these questions around whether private sector can do it better because the incentives are different, right? But yeah, I'd love to get your brief take on that if you have one.
It's interesting. I mean, if you look at the US, which is quite useful in what they've got right, there's a much greater ability to be in MIT, then go into government for a while, come back to MIT, then go into the private sector, come back. And what that enables more than anything else, and this is really the struggle for government, is asking better questions. You don't need the expertise because they're developing AI. You need them to be able to ask the right questions, to be able to generate the right asks of industry to deliver solutions. And that's the real challenge. And yes, we're fortunate to have locations like DSTL, where you've got probably 2,000 scientists there. Mm. But it's then also extracting that expertise in so that fairly low-level individuals who can tap into that expertise so they can ask a better question of industry to solve that problem because it's better informed. Great. And that was the genesis of the Battle Lab more than anything else. It was recognizing that, for want of a better phrase, we were unintelligent customers, particularly when you've got data science-driven technologies. And it's like, well, I'm not a data scientist. I don't know what AI can do. So I'm not even asking the right question in the first place. Mm. But if you can get that sort of support to then put that out to industry, which can do it better. And I think there's elements that have been very traditionally military focused that in recent years have been democratized by technologies, methodologies, in a way that defense will never now be able to have an exquisite hold or even be the best people to deliver that. Open source intelligence probably being the best example of that. Yeah, and the sheer volume of data and how you need to parse that and what data you need when. Well, yeah, companies can do that better in many ways.
So I mean, again, so something like Five Eyes, for example, would like from what you're saying just there, would an argument be that actually the amount of data that is now coming through those sort of programs would be better handled by private enterprise?
Well, not just Five Eyes. I mean, coming back to the OSINT piece, let's just take satellite imagery. Previously, that was, when we started our careers, that was the exquisite domain of defense and national security. And it cost a lot of money to retask a satellite for a period to go and get some high value shots. Mm. Now I can get my credit card out and go and buy. People are shooting tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of images every single day. Mm. The problem you've got then is you've got hundreds, if not millions of images that then need to be processed.
A lot of noise. Yeah.
And I've still got one intelligence analyst sat there like,
you just clicking can't, on a button.
Yeah.
Scrolling. Scrolling on what's on his
exactly
phone.
Yeah. That. But then that's when the AI question comes into play. And then we need to be able to ask, but once we start to understand that, yes, I want to ask AI to be able to filter that data for me so that individual can press that button to ask the question and get the result in near real time, then we're starting to get to the nub of what the problem is that needs solving.
I think There is a whole conversation that we could probably have around that, and especially I think the kind of the data side of things, because I mean, like, we already know that within private enterprise data is just immense and just a black hole, and I can only imagine within within the defense sector it's even bigger and even more important, right? To differentiate, to your point, right? If you've got 10,000 satellite images, you want to be able to pick out the one where, okay, well, it looks like there is a terrorist cell being built in this area and we need to maybe take a look at that, rather than, okay, this is a, this is a family that's going out on a nice jolly. I want to kind of move forward and talk about where we are today. And we had a brief discussion about this when we first met. I kind of called it the sort of zeitgeist of distraction, right? Or you called it a zeitgeist of distraction, actually, to be fair. Because there's a lot of noise right now about state-on-state aggression. We're all talking about Ukraine, Taiwan, the return of potentially big war. But you've described this as more of a sideshow, or at the very least a distraction from the real long-term threats. So what is the actual security zeitgeist that you think isn't being talked about? And how do you see MD1's role in surfacing or responding to that?
Well, I wouldn't say any particular matter is a sideshow. Mm. I would say that each matter is placed within a context of contest. Mm-hmm. That's a bit of a mouthful. There are a whole range of different geopolitical narratives and geopolitical priorities being played out, and a whole load of different states, you know, contesting each other, mm. or partnerships, alliances contesting each other, seeking to promote their ideas, seeking to promote their objectives, you know, gain national resources, gain territory, mm-hmm. or the opposite, you know. However it sits, I think everything is within a context of there's a lot going on. Mm. So I wouldn't say one matter is more or less important than the other. Mm. I certainly wouldn't say within different contexts there is a sideshow. What I would say is that to the people who are in those scenarios, it is the most important thing
of course.
That's around. And from our perspective, it's effectively up to us to see what government policy is, mm. identify what leadership is prioritizing in national interest and mm. international interest, and work out where contribution can be made, mm. if that makes sense. I know that sounds like a deeply political answer, but it's one that I think is important because one can't pick a particular theme or mm-hmm. a particular problem set to go for. Mm-hmm. Because firstly, in private industry, that's not our business.
Yeah, sure.
And it also rightly shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. You know, we shouldn't be deciding the fate of certain macro geopolitical outcomes. That's the role of elected governments to do. Mm. So that's the first sort of, you know, rather mild perspective.
And not to kind of interrupt, but exactly to your point, right? Who would have thought up until 2 or 3 weeks ago, the world would have been sort of put into massive macro turmoil on the supply side, right? In terms of supply chain, yeah. because of tariffs and because of some of the actions that have been taken in the US and the on again, off again, and all of this sort of stuff, right? But, you know, putting aside, you know, again, we as we said at the start, we tend to think about defense in terms of military action, but actually defense is across many, many different sectors, supply chain, et cetera, being one of them. And actually today, one could argue that that is probably top of the agenda for a lot of leaders across the globe, right? How do we deal with this particular issue? That doesn't mean that other issues have been are diminished or are less relevant. It's just that, yes, there needs to be an adequate prioritization of where
I think in really simple terms, this isn't an either or binary conversation. And, you know, in real terms, so the zeitgeist is arguably, if we say that's what's capturing the most attention at the moment, in recent years, it's been Ukraine. Mm. Ukraine is a war on a battlefield, things that Will and I understand intimately. But that's not necessarily where we need to focus our attention, but some parts will. Mm. When you get to a battlefield, you need to win. Mm. Ideally, you want to make sure you never get to a battlefield in the first place. Yeah. And it comes back to your point where and a lot of what our thesis is built around and our portfolio companies is it's that prevention in the first place. So defense in the most traditional sense of the word and security, very much so, you know, ensuring you never get to conflict in the first place. And that comes back to some of the points we've already discussed around security of supply chains, security of information, data security, that side of things. We've in many ways our thesis has been proved right, partly by the actions of the US, mm-hmm. Partly by the actions of the Chinese this week with British Steel, and just so reducing our dependencies or vulnerabilities is probably the best way of phrasing it, so that we can ensure that we never get to that. And it's worth remembering, you know, within our lifetime, you know, the Cold War, when it was happening, was a largely military-driven balance of terror to make sure we never got to the battlefield in the first place.
Yeah. how do we stop the other guy nuking us, essentially?
Or make it so unpalatable that no one ever does.
Yeah. I mean, mutually assured. So this is an interesting point, right? So mutually assured destruction was essentially the nature of the Cold War, right? Now, yes, there's been some deproliferation, right? But like it still exists.
The sword of Damocles still exists.
Yeah.
But arguably, again, coming back to the steelworks, and what you hear called the grey zone, grey zone conflict, and that's something. It's not really conflict. It's economic aggression. Yeah. It's economic forward planning so that you can collapse other parts. Like why would you destroy city and kill millions if you can just...
Well, if China could stop supplying chips, if they, you know, annex Taiwan, supplying chips, that's a fair chunk of the West in fairly dire straits, right?
Exactly. So, you know, when you look at our portfolio, most of it's not, well, nearly all of it's not to do with that. It's much more around prevention, security. Mm. We've got some hardware in there as well, good companies like Green Jets. But again, the whole dual use piece is that it has a use in defence. Defence is very useful as a client because it's always underpinning financially. It's a good investment in that sense. That
it's also a good testing ground, right?
Yeah, and it doesn't go broke and it pays its bills. And, you know, so if you put that, if you map that on a graph while the stock market's, you know, bouncing up and down, but really growth comes from the private sector. You know, that's, those are the returns. So you've got to have, that's our sense of dual use and why it's important from a fiduciary and from a national security perspective.
And this is where our whole thesis drives towards, it's not defence, it's everything.
Yeah.
So you can't simply be a defence investor because you're missing the dramatic contribution that cross-government partners contribute to problem sets. Mm. So if one wants to be a
It's like the argument that the internet was developed for military, or even GPS developed for military purposes, but look at it now, right?
Yeah.
What are the uses now?
So we prefer to look at macro problems and the micro solutions that are delivered by national security partners, national security interests. Mm. And you're completely correct in that whilst there are a whole range of major issues and matters going on from the whole spectrum of an economic contest to tragic human suffering across the whole spectrum of of the world as it is, and you know the tragic reality of it.
Yeah.
What we seek to try and do is take an objective view and try and identify ways that value and contribution can be contributed to these problems.
Mm.
And by doing that, you end up seeing the most fascinating solutions being developed. Incredible founders who are you know, sometimes having quite off-the-wall ideas and saying, hey, well, how about we try this? And there are two things that the national security community is able to do. Firstly, have the freedom and flexibility through both existing procurement methods and also new procurement methods that policymakers have implemented recently in order to be able to achieve this, which is, let's have a look, let's have a go. Ed's work at the Battle Lab was great. I mean, obviously, as I would think so, but it was great because, you know, it was, let's have a look at this.
Would have been very awkward if he said
yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Rubbish. Yeah. Useless. You know, it was, you know, let's bring this in. Let's have a look at what you've created. Let's show it to some end users and see what's what. And then the second part of it is, let's see how this product or service could be funded.
Yeah.
And that's really the way ahead.
Yeah. I mean, again, whilst you were talking, the thought that came to my mind, and again, this is sort of related to the events of the last month, 2 months, you know, where the US has seemingly abrogated sort of responsibility, seemingly seems to be withdrawing from kind of the global leadership role that it's played since sort of the end of World War II, seemingly, you know, withdrawing funding as much as anything else. So Mike, one of my questions to you, which, you know, which sort of came to mind just now was, A, thinking about the UK and Europe, what is it that, where do we have an advantage, I guess, in terms of the technology you guys invest in? Like where do you see thematically the most value being created and where do we have real advantage? And then secondly, and I know I have an opinion on this for sure, do you think that the actions that the US has taken have galvanized UK, Europe in a way that potentially wouldn't have happened without those actions having been taken?
I think the old adage that, you know, has always existed that we produce great engineers, great scientists, you know, great technologists, but then don't scale it.
Yeah.
Still rings true. But that's why we went into the venture side of things. It's why we set up the fund, because a lot of the success from the US comes from that access to capital and therefore a willingness to not sell at 20 million and have a comfortable, you know, low level retirement, but actually, you know, shoot for the moon and do more interesting things. And I think arguably there's a lot of British founders out there that have founded great businesses that, well, most people think they're US businesses. They weren't.
Yeah.
They went and got lots of US VC capital, moved to San Francisco and Silicon Valley.
And there's a lot of that in the news at the moment. Yeah, again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That. So why wouldn't, there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to incubate things here. Mm-hmm. But it's still an early market. Mm-hmm. So there's still a lot of incubating in Europe, scaling in the US. But pre-seed, Series A, we can do some serious incubation with some serious numbers.
Mm. And I would caution, in the current market period, and you know, the time of our recording, you know, significant political economic volatility going on, a whole load of moves, an element of the world order is being rewritten in terms of the current tariff positioning. This is a perfect opportunity to make the point that we invest for the long term, and everything is designed to be counter-cyclical. So this does not represent an opportunity to completely upend you know, almost multi-generational relationships and partnerships. It's not an opportunity to say the US has for the time being done this, therefore, okay, right, that's that, let's do this. It simply is a matter to identify and reflect, right, what needs to be done now, what needs to be achieved. You know, where are the policymakers going to be reconciling and finding a new status quo that works within the world order? Then our job as investors is to take a 5 to 10 year view.
Where does this go from here?
Correct.
Rather than where are we now?
Yeah. Exactly. And how is that? How do we need to behave within our fiduciary responsibilities over our investment horizon? So that's the really sort of nuanced part about this. It's not to do with, right, this happened right now, therefore, you know, the market is doing this, therefore we need to.
Yeah.
We have to just sort
it's
of.
It's not a reaction replay.
Correct. Yeah. We have to keep focusing on what is the product or service that in the immediate term and in the long term we can see the end user community is driving for and the market community. And then what are the innovators and the founders doing in order to be able to either address those needs or come up with new ideas that need to be presented to the end user community to say, hey, you haven't even thought that you need this. Take a look. So that's our sort of perspective.
What we are also seeing now is that a reminder, a very stark reminder, that security and vigilance is a collective endeavor. What's interesting from the technology side of things, which is something that's changing, is that small to medium enterprises are producing parts of the solution. Now, governments across the board are still set up to sign one contract once, which is why you see defense prime still being the primary recipients of government money, but they can't do all of these things. And some of these truly interesting technologies, they are slivers of the solution who then need to join a consortium, form consortiums, collectively bid in order to provide a full stack solution to a tender problem set that's been published by government. Everyone's getting better at doing it. And that's the thing that's really interesting. And the primes do have a place in all of this as well, in terms of being able to you know, create these consortiums. And also, in the case of catastrophic success with a government contract, be able to assist with scaling on that side of things.
I love that phrase, catastrophic success. That sounds both intriguing, but also quite scary. And I mean, but drawing on these points, right? So, you know, Ed, as you said, like if one of the problems is, okay, yes, we can do pre-seed, seed, series A really well, but actually then we have this capital gap. And it's, again, it's across all sectors in the UK and Europe. We know that, right? It you know, in fact, I had a conversation with one of the major banks doing sort of early stage innovation banking and growth banking, et cetera. That gap post-series B is still a really hard kind of chasm to cross here. But save for those capital gaps, which clearly exist. And yes, there are ways of unlocking some of that patient capital from pension funds, et cetera, maybe there is more government stimulus into these areas. Where else would you say the UK, or what could the UK do more to kind of beef up that focus on security, vigilance, collectively,
depends,
as you say?
It depends what you mean by the UK. I suppose there's the UK market and there's UK government. And there are
kind of both, I guess.
The topic of topics, you know, in conversations, dinners, et cetera, is it always results in everyone agreeing vehemently and violently that UK government needs to do more to improve procurement. So I suppose let's avoid that.
I'm at the wrong dinners, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Or maybe the right ones.
There are the right ones. However, you know, one of the most interesting points is okay, well, if there is this general understanding that the growth stage, like access to growth stage capital is a problem, then one way to get around it and one way to try and mitigate that perceived risk is to, as early as possible, introduce and socialize founding teams with as many diverse investors from as many different backgrounds and subsectors as possible. Because then, of course, the founders get the opportunity to identify different potential sources of future capital that come from different sectors.
And potentially different markets, because they're all connected to different.
Exactly. Yeah, sure. They're very well funded. So something we try and do is it really isn't a gimmick. It's something that's highly active and specific within how we like to think and how we like to work with founders. They say, fine, you have got a good opportunity here in this market. You've got a good opportunity here in this market. You've got an idea for this one. Have you spoken to all of the people that you feel you need to in order to be able to make a conscious, informed decision? And you find that quite often they haven't had the opportunity to. So that's where it's incredibly enjoyable and rewarding to be able to say, okay, fine, Let's go and introduce you to some fintech investors and see what they take.
Is this a rare example of VCs in the wild being helpful? Like this feels like,
well, I mean,
quite contrary to, yeah. to receive wisdom.
You've heard it here first.
Yeah.
But I think your point is, to do that late stage funding, we need to, you know, people will come if it's going to make them money.
It's
incumbent on us to ensure that we're creating an environment where it's attractive.
I think that's a really key point, is there is a risk aversion still, I think throughout Europe, UK included, and a hesitancy around both technology as well as moonshot technology, I think, right?
Yeah. And so if we can create that environment, once you've had the successes, and bearing in mind that, you know, when you look at the successes from our sector, you know, the US ones that have become unicorns, we're still not talking about something that is a mature market where we can point to, you know, a unicorn that wasn't set up by a billionaire, for example. That sort of thing. But equally, yes, government could do more as well. You can incentivize, you know, as they have done with entrepreneurial tax relief and that side of things. But also we're starting to see some of the seeds of change around ESG and things like that. So some of the barriers are starting to come down as well, which will definitely help.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, look, again, I mean, like, this is, I need to at some point get a bigger room and a dozen interested parties, because, you know, the conversations that keep arising on this podcast is capital gap at later stage, IPO market in Europe, UK, like, how do we incentivize founders to remain, and not necessarily remain, but like, if founders and their teams are exiting in the UK and in Europe, then that capital is much more likely to get recycled in the ecosystem. And that's where you see the potential. Whereas at the moment, you know, there's an FT article, there's a couple of people I know who were quoted in there, where, you know, there's very much this argument, well, we go to the US because we've got capital, but we've got the best talent actually sitting in UK and Europe, and it's cheaper than the US. So they're kind of having their cake and eating it because they're able to go out there, raise the capital, but also benefit from the kind of lower cost environment over here. What I'd love to see is, exactly to your point, more capital coming in at those later stages so that those teams continue to remain here, but that capital then getting recycled through the ecosystem. I feel like, and I might be wrong here, the UK especially and Europe more generally is maybe a smaller, tighter knit market. You know, the US is very, very broad, both geographically as well as kind of more generally in terms of the market. And I feel like, to your earlier point, you'd see a lot more collaboration actually if a lot of those businesses were here, because this ecosystem is still quite small. And I think the one thing, again, which has come up, you know, quite a few times on the pod, is we're still relatively immature as a market compared to the US for venture, right? So the US, you know, it's from the 60s onwards, really venture in the UK arguably started post.com, probably post GFC. So we're only 15, 20 years into this. So there is some catching up to be done. But I guess the thing that I worry about, stroke hope doesn't happen, is that it doesn't stop us from building very, very consequential businesses.
I think it's slightly the opposite for investors, because actually it's not a saturated market.
Yeah, exactly. The opportunity is even more.
And the opportunity for larger percentage returns is in Europe.
Yeah.
One of the things that is a difference, though, is also VCs that are set up by founders.
Yeah. You know,
the percentage is far greater in the US. Now, we have founders as part of
the 60% in the US versus 8% in Europe.
Exactly. And we made a very conscious decision that people that are part of MD1 at a board level, at a partner level, have done exactly that route. It was a key thought behind how we structured the company.
Yeah, operate first, invest second. So look, moving on, because again, like, these are conversations that could go in lots of different directions. But when we first met, you talked about kind of this death by a thousand cables idea, right? So I find it really fascinating. It was something that intuitively I understood and would have known, but hadn't thought about, right? So subsea infrastructure being tampered with, and you talked about it earlier, gray zone activity sort of escalating. and especially the UK's vulnerability due to everything coming in over or underwater, right? So we're either shipping goods in or we're piping gas or electricity or even the internet in underwater, right? It's not sexy. It doesn't make headlines. No one's out on the Telegraph shouting, you know, we're talking about small boats, but no one's actually talking about what's going on under the channel. But it could cripple us overnight, right? Like it's a massive potential vulnerability, right? So why do you think we failed to take what you call the easy technological steps? And what even are those steps? What would they even look like?
I would say there are certain environments like complex subsea environments whereby nobody, for various reasons, both interest and also classification, nobody really knows or should know what's going on. Mm. And there's an environment whereby, much like cyber attacks, for example, generally speaking, the population doesn't hear about the fact that there is even this entire world until something goes wrong.
Yeah.
So I think it is important to put it in the context of that. However, you're absolutely right. How I would phrase it is contest is being presented in a greater asymmetric manner than previously. Mm. So as opposed to, an economic or a physical, conflict, for example, we're now seeing a whole range of additional trade conflicts. Mm. You know, one could view the current American position with regards to tariffs as being something akin to disrupting supply chains. So you're seeing disruption of supply chains, you're seeing disruption of status quo. And of course, a lot of the infrastructure, critical national and international infrastructure being disrupted, is another example of the sort of threats that we are seeing as the UK, Europe and allies from our adversaries. Mm. So it's one of those things where all of a sudden we know about it, or the...
It's suddenly come to mind. Yeah.
The public perspective has been made aware of this. So therefore, the natural reaction is, gosh, what do we need to do with this? But in fact, there's plenty of existing resource capabilities that are able to identify certain threats and mitigate certain threats. Mm. But now a greater focus needs to be presented, and a greater level of resourcing needs to be focused on some of these mitigants. Mm. So really, it's a constant game of cat and mouse and resource allocation based on priorities. Mm. And we're quite lucky; we don't have to do that. We just have to make the best financial course that we can.
And it is that resource allocation.
Just to dig into that a bit more, right? So to your point, if it's not visible, right? Yeah. Like if it is something that the vast majority of people are not aware of, going back to your point around cross-disciplinary and cross kind of collaborative approaches, are there founders out there that are thinking about this, right? Like who have the expertise and the knowledge, but also the breadth of expertise, if I can put it that way, or skill sets to tackle these things? Because it feels like, maybe it only gets addressed when something goes wrong.
Well, the great way of viewing it is the oil industry has a whole range of undersea survey capabilities.
Right.
And now, of course, there are opportunities for those businesses and those engineers to apply their technologies to this problem set.
But there's also a lot of these technologies are having their PC moment where they're becoming cheaper, more ubiquitous, largely disposable.
More scalable.
And this is what you're seeing on a lot of the conversation around the battlefields. But equally, it's going to be far easier to survey, perpetually surveil these undersea capabilities. But I'd also say that you've got to remember, and we can use the recent examples of ships that have dragged anchors probably deliberately in order to sever cables.
Oh, interesting.
No, there weren't mass blackouts, but it was a problem, and resources then have to be allocated to address that problem. And that's kind of the point. It's like when I'm asked, could Russia invade Europe? It's like, it doesn't really need
to.
It just needs to keep pulling on various threads, draining you of your resources, tying you up, energy, making life difficult.
It's interesting. Again, I lived out in Papua New Guinea for 10 years. And what springs to mind is they had one cable coming in, supplying internet to the whole country, right? Like it was a massive, Papua New Guinea is a massively resource-rich country, but it's not a massively advanced country. When I arrived there, we were still on 56 kpbs dial-up. Like we were on modems. There was no mobile phones. It was 2% coverage for mobile phones, and they cost £1,000 each or whatever, which was obviously not affordable for the vast majority of people. But I became very acutely aware of that vulnerability, because we would often have internet outages, and it all improved over time, and mobile telephony kind of blew up when we had an Irish company, Digicel, come out there and expand the services and so on. But I guess it's one of these first world problems, right? We don't think about where we don't really think about where our energy supply is coming from, where our internet supply is coming from, you know, where our gas is being piped in from, or any of these sort of things until it goes wrong. And actually, for most of the population, like, the thought process of, well, I'll just ring up my provider and they'll, you know, they'll tell me there's an outage and engineers are on their way. But, you know, I guess not, and again, not to catastrophize, right? But to your point, like, it's no longer about, do we send a missile over? But it's like, okay. And, you know, the internet is the best example of this. Like, you know, over the last 10 years, it's seemingly very clear that non-state actors have been, or state actors, sorry, have been highly participant in social media and disinformation campaigns and all of these sort of things, which again, like, are massive vulnerabilities. You know, one could argue, you know, whatever your sort of thoughts on the outcome, one could argue that, you know, the Brexit debate was very much influenced in that way. You could argue that some of the US elections were very much sort of influenced in those ways. And of course, there's been, you know, a lot of sci-fi as well as reality that has gone into kind of, you know, have some of these businesses, the Cambridge Analytics, et cetera, of the world, really influence true kind of, you know, real life elections and outcomes.
Well, there's also no need to beat around the bush. Like, Russia invaded Ukraine and inflicted upon them the most extraordinary amount of human suffering,
yeah,
you know, disruption, destructive intent possible.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're completely correct. Amongst all of these nuanced factors that demonstrate examples on a multifaceted way, you also have the most egregious.
Yeah.
Behavior just that one could imagine.
But, yeah. War, bloody war.
But, right? But your point on the physical internet is a great example, and it's also a great example of where venture it gets exciting. You know, this is some of the stuff. You know, the answer to, you know, securing the physical internet is, I don't know, you know, better cables
or Starlink,
or exactly that point, Starlink. Yeah. Someone's just answered that question in a completely different way because space became more accessible, cheaper,
interesting,
and you do that, and suddenly you completely negate the need. Of course, there will then be a threat there, which you'll then need to counter because that's the cycle.
But, yeah. You know, well, but interestingly, with Starlink, the threat seems to be coming just as much from Starlink as from elsewhere, right?
So the answer is more Starlinks.
Yeah. No, look, I mean, I think the UK actually, and, you know, to some extent was able to grow in the way that it did grow over the, you know, 16th, 17th, 18th centuries and 19th century rather, because of its isolation as an island, its massive sort of naval expertise. You know, it still astounds me, right? Like, the UK essentially took over India by one company that had one office in one street in London. Like, I mean, it was, you know, it was not the UK. It was not the English state or the British state that essentially took over India. It was the East India Company, right? And it feels like that, I mean, obviously that's all diminished and obviously empire is no longer. But I wonder, you know, it's interesting. What was once a strength, it feels like, is now more of a vulnerability, right? That and the fact that we're an island, the fact that we are isolated to that extent, we're not part of kind of mainland Europe, etc. Like, I just wonder. I wonder whether that means we have to work doubly hard to defend.
Yeah, I think that's true to a large extent, and I think it just. We deal with our own specific threats that we have to deal with, you know, threats that are less of a problem for Germany, for example. Mm. But it's just different in many ways.
Well, this is a really interesting topic, though, because at present, time recording, and no doubt into the future, there will be an ongoing debate with regards to the disruption of the sort of globalist status quo.
Yep.
And the true free market in all senses and all definitions. And you're now seeing the fundamental concept of European sovereignty having been already materially damaged and threatened. Mm. So you're seeing, you know, to your point earlier, you're seeing an element of a galvanizing effect, both from the aggression from Russia and disruption from recent global policies. Mm. So the so what is there a European galvanization? Is there a new European?
100%. I actually argue that the two biggest factors that will have brought the UK closer to Europe are both Brexit and a Trump government. It's quite incredible.
So then you've got to work out the extent to which, conceptually speaking, and both with, you know, announcements and policy views How will that actually cascade into the market? So how will the sentiment of a galvanizing effect translate into actual revenue production? So, for example, the Europeans are issuing their clarifications with regards to the intent for defence public spending, particularly the debt instruments that they're going to be issuing. And the UK is not involved in that because the UK is not part of the EU. So there's a whole load of ifs and buts that will start to come out, and there will be caveats placed. And nations will then now present, and rightly so, have the opportunity to present their caveats and their requirements to the collective. So from our perspective as investors, but also all of us as members of this whole European community, to the extent to which the Europeans allow us to say that, it's probably, probably not really fair. But, you know, we need to be aware that whilst sentiment and intent may point in one direction, we've got to be incredibly alive to the fact that reality may
push us in another.
Yeah. So that's really key. We can't just assume, oh, right, there's going to be a whole load of defence spending and that's going to result in... You've really got to look into the detail. You've really got to dig into what that actually means and where you actually think revenue will be allocated. Because the one thing we can guarantee is it won't be as presented from the initial press release.
Look, I mean, again, it's a topic that is so broad, so vast, and so, I mean... so dependent on a multitude of different factors, right? It's dependent on, yes, what does the US do? It's dependent on what China does. It's dependent on what Russia does. Equally, it's dependent on what each individual member state of the European Union does, and where the UK positions itself in alignment or non-alignment with those member states. And, you know, not only that, which government is in power at what time and at what phase and at what particular moment when an event occurs or doesn't occur, that will guide, you know, the principles of how that alignment then moves forward. And I think it's interesting because there's a huge amount of debate online. Andreas Klinger is kind of leading this sort of EU acceleration kind of gambit. And one of the things he's been arguing for, well, the two things that he argues very clearly for at the start from a private sector from a startup perspective is an EU Inc., so a Europe-wide company structure, similar to a Delaware Corp., that everyone, every founder should speak English because, like, that is the language of business and of, you know, commerce, and the likelihood is you're going to end up in the US if you are trying to grow a venture scale business. And my point with all of this is the more aligned that can become, right? And again, looking at it from the venture lens, the easier it is going to be for people to make appropriate decisions and for you guys to make appropriate decisions as to where and how and what you'll invest in. And, you know, the argument has always been, for example, angels hate investing in Germany because you've got to go sit in front of a notary and, you know, listen to them and have everything stamped and, you know, all the rest of it. And if you can change the nature of that, if you remove some of those barriers, which are frankly ludicrous barriers, then all of a sudden you open up that market in a much bigger way and actually allow many more participants into the market to do what they need to do. But again, comes back to your point.
Yeah.
What direction are you aligned
in? And it also comes back to that point of, you know, companies at the moment provide slivers of the solution rather than the full set solution. But we're already seeing these partnerships now, you know, German AI companies partnering with hardware drone companies, setting up, you know, investing in the UK. There will be more of that, and it just needs to get easier. But equally, I think, is that the signals from the market saying this needs to happen, government gets better at reacting to very obvious, like you, lighthouse moments.
And the market will adapt in response to capital allocation.
Yeah.
You know, I was at the European Defence Fund's open day last week or the week before, where it was very clear that the policymakers outlined their intent. They specified where they'd be allocating capital. They acknowledged that they hadn't quite worked through some of the details. But the point was, if we are clear and we allocate capital, the market will adapt and adjust to the requirements. So I think we just have to be alive to that reality. And, you know, the German notary anecdote is one of the most frustrating but real points. People just say, you know what, I'm just not going to do that investment.
Yeah.
And that's frustrating. So it's clearly got to the point, however, because Germany offers such a compelling market, such a compelling operational and intellectual engineering academic base from which to see financial opportunities, that hasn't dissuaded investors from investing in Germany.
We had the largest European seed fund on, one of the partners from the largest European seed fund on, and it is a private public fund, right? Their LPs include government, but also Mercedes or, you know, all of the sort of German manufacturing powerhouses, and their model has worked incredibly well. And this goes back to exactly what you guys are talking about, collaboration, et cetera, because they are able to get their portfolio in front of these players quickly, validate their ideas, understand whether the pain point, the solution, et cetera, is all valid, and move forward, right? And grow much quicker. And yeah, I feel like actually, you know, you get a lot of, there's a lot of shade thrown on Europe generally about being overly bureaucratic and, you know, you shouldn't have public sector interfering in early stage. I wonder whether, or I would argue that actually in security and defense, there's almost an argument that we should have more of that rather than less.
Well, you've also got to respect people's differences. I mean, Europe isn't Europe. Europe is, you know,
exactly.
The cultural differences between the Finnish and the Spanish.
Yeah.
You know, and that's great. You know, that's the whole point.
Yeah.
So I think it's just, you know, the common operating and the common business picture is one factor. But the others, you shouldn't just force people into a mold. I think everyone's got to do what they do in the manner in which they wish to do it. And that's absolutely fine. And from an investing perspective, we see so many different interesting ideas coming out from all over the place that say, you know what, I hadn't even thought that there could be a national security application to this. Mm. So let's talk it through.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the interesting part.
We've invested in businesses that were set up at the opposite end of the ideological political spectrum. I mean, SatView is a sort of good case in point. You're doing thermal imaging from space for climate change.
Yeah.
But looking at what generates heat is quite a useful thing from a national security perspective.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. I mean, look, all of these things. Look, it's very easy, on a podcast like this, the temptation is to try and distill everything into, like, not necessarily sound bites, but very, you know, easy to grasp concepts. Reality about everything we're talking about is there is nothing simple. There is nothing, you know, vanilla about anything we're doing. You know, if only it were. And in fact, and this kind of leads to my kind of final sort of large question, if I can put it that way, which is, you know, we've talked about it a little bit on this podcast, but I want to get maybe a bit more detail or clarity from you. And it's about this idea of the great game. So you've referenced the idea that we're back in the great game, right? Just with different players and stakes. So, you know, if the 20th century, as you'd said earlier, was defined by the arms race, nuclear deterrence, and, you know, the Damocles sword. I couldn't figure out the right way around, but yeah. Is the 21st century defined by digital infrastructure, space, and economic dependencies? And how do you think about the parallels with that Cold War, and where do they actually break down? And I talked a little bit about this, but like if you were to kind of think about that as a very direct juxtaposition, how would you define that?
I'd love to have said, absolutely. Yeah. We're back in the great game, which I think the grey zone largely is, and therefore we're now looking at, you know, economic statecraft and all the rest of it. But I probably wouldn't have picked selling off a bunch of coke in order to shut down a furnace. And it turns out if you shut down a furnace, it breaks. That wouldn't have been on my strategic bingo card. So I think it's useful, actually. You know, all of these things just highlight that we don't know, you know, what we don't know, and therefore needs to be involved across all aspects. I think what is interesting is the sort of peace dividend idea where we said, we'll buy cheap Chinese technology, whether that's around cameras, you know, all of these sorts of things. And now your smart port systems, you know, openly, they advertise that they can control the cranes from China. Like, that might not have been the greatest, but it was bought for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
It was cheap, did the same job that it was needed to do. But now, you know, the window's moved on these.
I would suggest perhaps that we're not back in a great game, or nothing's really changed. I think there are two things that everyone needs to be aware of. Firstly, both, you know, public and private sector, those within security services agencies, whatever, all around the world, everyone's seeking to address the priorities on a prioritization matrix. They have to address the most pressing threats first, and they have to resource the most pressing and urgent threats. And that's their responsibility. Police forces have to police where they think is the greatest risk, et cetera, et cetera. So it's one of those scenarios where we're clearly in a scenario where the priorities have changed. So therefore, everybody needs to do their part and respond to it. Now, private capital will be able to do so once they see very clear demand signals and you know, revenue drivers saying from the end users saying, look, we need this product or service. We really need it. It's important. It goes against certain priorities. Whether we, through different classification levels, should be or are even privy to it or not, you know, sometimes so long as a contract is issued, it's none of our business.
Doesn't
it's
matter why.
None of our business.
What, what we really need to do though is get industry closer to those end users. Because, you know, in simple terms, the military, someone like me as an officer gets posted on my 2-year posting. I'm now the head of AI for whatever department. Don't know what that is, but I'm responsible for writing the requirements that then go out to industry. You give it your best shot, gets responded, they deliver it, and you go, that's exactly what I asked for. Not actually what I need.
What I need.
But that's innovation, because we'll redo the whole cycle because I've learned something, but I'm getting to my next posting next
week.
So the next guy's going to
come.
So the more we can demystify defence, you know, and I'm fully on board with taking people from other parts of the political divide. You know, we dealt with Bournemouth Arts University, which is not an obvious one to deal with. But the stuff they do was incredible, you know, and completely different field. But the more we can get there so that, you know, businesses build products by interrogating the market and what the market needs and then solving that problem. The market's not always good at telling you what it needs, which is why you do discovery and market research and all that sort of stuff to tease out those problem sets. And that's exactly, it comes back to the battle lab piece of like getting those users to sit there and go, I don't know. And then going, well, tell me about this. And like, well, you know, what's a problem in your day? And it's like, well, I'd like to, you know, not have to do this and shave some time. And it's like, what if we just didn't need you anymore and you could go and do a more fun job? Like, yeah, okay, cool. Like, you know, it's that level.
Yeah.
And then you get that. And the more that the users can be educated, the better the requirements that can then be serviced.
Yeah.
There are some hurdles around, you know, how government's constructed in doing these things. But, you know,
they're not insurmountable either.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think we've been motivated in a way like never before.
And this is a go-to-market problem, by the way, that is exactly the same for any investor across any sector, for any founder across any sector. You know, everything seems impenetrable when you don't know much about it, and it seems even more impenetrable when you know a little bit about it. But the reality is, across a whole range of other sectors, not just national security defence, there are still exactly the same problems. You've got to identify your market. You've got to speak to people. You've got to build those relationships. You've got to adapt your product. How do you spend your money to adapt a prototype when you're not quite sure what the end user requirement might be in the future? Now, all of these things are iterative, and it's entirely common across a whole range of investment or innovation sectors. So I suppose from our perspective, we're just trying to identify and empower the founders in a manner that you can say, no, don't worry, it's fine. You know, yes, we understand it's a problem, but let's get these conversations going and let's try and equip you with the information that you need or the best information as possible, not necessarily the ones you actually need, but the information that's available to you in order to be able to seek to best address those big questions.
And a lot of this is actually helping them not squander time.
Yeah. I was going to say the reality is, like, if I think about, you know, if I'm building a B2B enterprise SaaS solution of some nature, I can get in front of users pretty quickly. Like, I just, you know, reach out to 100 people on LinkedIn and say, hey, 15-minute chat and I'll buy you a coffee or whatever. Feels like that's probably harder in defense writ large. And therefore, the ability to get those end users closer to those, you know, founders quicker,
yeah,
is always going to be, you know, massively value additive, because it speeds up the cycle of innovation within those founding teams, but it also presumably gives those users the ability to understand what's out there, right? And and solutions that they haven't thought of and applications that they wouldn't have considered are suddenly being surfaced, and may even, and obviously we see this a lot with, you know, companies that pivot from, you know, one application to another, you might have a founder go sit in front of someone within, again, defense writ large, saying, well, I've got a solution that does X. And the user goes, I don't need it to do X, but you know what, it'd be bloody good at doing Y. And all of a sudden you've opened up a completely different
You know, I was a cavalry tank commander, and if the answer is always going to be, I just need a better tank,
It's a better mousetrap. until someone
comes along and says, hey, have you thought, you are aware that technology is doing this over here in this completely different field. It's like, great.
Could you invent football if there wasn't a ball lying around?
Yeah.
Is one way of thinking about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, being able to say to everyone,
I had to kill a pig.
It's one of those scenarios where you say, okay, well, here's a whole range of things. Here's a whole range of products, services, ideas that either are in use in other sectors, or someone's had an idea for something. And if you can foster and generate that conversation, it's amazing what you come up with.
Well, I guess, so the obvious kind of use case or the obvious example would be and I don't know the answer to this, maybe you both do, were drones invented, for example, were drones a military first application, were they a mass market private application?
Well, a drone is a remote controlled plane. Yeah. So, you know, I had one when I was a child.
That's true. Yeah.
So it's one of those things where, you know, did I have a weapon? I probably did the way I flew it. But, you know it, so entirely fair.
Yeah.
And all of these cart, you know, and horse matters and all the topics, that is the reality of it. So as opposed to trying to define it, we just go with the flow.
We just
go with it and we try and see where utility and value can be found.
What has changed over the last, you know, numerous decades is that defence was largely in the driving seat of technology. You know, a lot of stuff came from defence and then went into the civilian sector.
Yeah.
And if you think of the advent of PCs and mobile phones, that was turned on its head completely. And at best, we were trying to keep up in ways that on an annualised budget is very, very difficult to do. But is starting to see things coming together on that side of things. And defence also getting into a mindset of being a procurer of novel technologies.
Rather than an innovator.
That, exactly. Yeah. And they can help with that innovation. Yeah, absolutely.
But they don't have to start the innovation themselves.
Yeah, it doesn't have to start in a lab somewhere. It could just be a consumer item.
Yeah.
And the big sea change will be when we truly get used to having disposable technologies.
Yeah.
And we're seeing that the drone market's a good example of that, in multi-million pound platforms that have to last for 10 years versus something that you can just buy from Currys and fly across the battlefield. You know, it's like, yeah.
Hopefully the military isn't buying their drones from Currys. But look, I mean, this has been an incredibly wide-ranging conversation. And again, as I said, I think we could go in multiple different directions. But I want to close off with a couple of slightly different, slightly softer questions. One I've asked all my guests for the last several months or year even. The last one is one that I've recently come up with because I thought it'd be nice to have a bit of a humanized question in here. But the first one, what is one thing that you both or either of you have a contrarian conviction about from any area of life, whether that's work, politics, socially or at home? What is the kind of hill that you would die on defending that others maybe wouldn't?
It's two different things for me. So the hill I would definitely die on is free speech. And I think you know, we've lost the ability to just tolerate others, no matter how difficult their views are. And particularly, you know, coming from the military originally, not always a popular organization, but happy to, well, on occasions you put your life on the line to defend people's ability to call you an awful human being, which fine. Yeah, I can live with that. Contrarian wise, I think anyone who found out that who knew me back in the day found I joined the military, that was about as contrarian as I could get. does not take direction well. Fairly independent. So as Will still suffers to this day. So,
I think then, you know, the thing that dying on the hill, I think to add to Ed's point, it's the conscious choice on when to make that call is the fascinating one for me. So, you know, my father gave me some great advice years ago, which was, you know, the majority of times when you're faced with a decision, you need to ask yourself the conscious question, am I willing to die in a ditch over this?
Yeah.
95% of the time, well, we hope 99%, 99.9% of the time, you consciously take a view and say, no, there's a way around it.
Yeah.
You need to do a bit more thinking. You need to communicate better with your team or your leadership, you know, all the different ways. But should the time come where you need to actually, I need to die in the ditch on this, you've got to do it. And that's the most important thing. So I suppose it's reinforcing that point about the dying on a hill thing is, and it doesn't need to be just a dramatic metaphor, but, you know, it really is about actually not just standing up for your convictions, but once you know you have to, actually doing it and making sure you see it through. And a contrarian view, oh, good Lord. I wouldn't even know where to go. I mean, I pretty much everything that the team tolerate with me is contrarian. I always take a slightly cynical view first.
Yeah.
So I've naturally found myself to be quite optimistic. So constructively, I present myself and I present my thought process to myself in the opposite way.
You sound like a CFO. Yeah.
Yeah, which is a bit, you know, bit miss. But what it means is that once you can then round the circle, and particularly as we all work together and as this thought processes come together, you can find a really healthy constructive equilibrium. So that's probably not how most people operate, but I've sort of taught myself to try and do that.
So you've taught yourself to be cynical first.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. I would say, because I'm equally very optimistic in general and can get a little bit carried away occasionally, And I think, that sort of natural cynicism or not even natural, but that's that forced cynicism.
Yeah.
Is especially because the environment that we work in, right? Like everything is exciting. Everything could be incredible, but you have to be able to say, hold on a second. Okay. Yeah. Yes, I can see where it can go, but what walls do I need to build enough conviction about? Like, what are the items that I should be cynical about? So that I can build enough conviction that, yes, if I'm going to make an investment, if I'm going to work with this company, if I'm going to do whatever, that stands. So, yeah, no, I like that. And so the final question, maybe so we can get to know the real yous, what moves you emotionally? Maybe start with you, Will.
Oh, music, hands down.
Okay.
Any form. Ted Lasso. Yeah, actually Ted Lasso is probably a much better answer. No, in all seriousness, very fond of music in every form.
Yeah.
And something done beautifully and executed beautifully.
Yeah. Are we more on the classical or the EDM side? Where do you
both? Yeah, I mean, some of the quality of some of the EDM stuff at the moment is extraordinary, but no, I mean, classical music, that's high art, so.
Okay. Amazing. Ed,
having just come back from hiking, I think the natural world is probably the thing. It is a solitary activity that you can really it can be spectacular in ways you never expected.
I love both of them. I actually identify with both of those answers incredibly well. Music is probably the only way I get into kind of flow, and the natural world is like, I came from Kenya and, going out and going on safari and just seeing the vast magnificence of the world around me is one of the beautiful things. And it actually is a nice kind of counterpoint to some of the conversation we've been having up until now, because I think, you know, there is a need to feel a little bit optimistic about what the world has to offer us. Look, it's been absolutely incredible having you both on the podcast. For our audience, where can they find you online? Are you on LinkedIn? Are you on Twitter? Where's the best place to look for you?
LinkedIn, website. And we're always very keen to promote the work that our portfolio companies are doing. So do check out some of our founder spotlights, which we're going to be doing to promote their work. And thank you very much indeed for having us.
It's been really enjoyable.
Thank you.